The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that has the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. Well, Adrian Gore standing by. We'll chat to him in just a moment. We've also got Mark Kittifani joining us. He is the chief executive of Anglo American. We'll look at the huge number of results and updates that came out of South African companies today, get a global perspective on economies and markets. Warren Ingram tonight with Personal Finance and Pablo Fatidis on Small Business, as always, on a Thursday.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
There's so many people who we never hear about who have been absolutely instrumental in our lives. They invented things, they created things, they've changed the world. And a guy you've probably never heard of, but if you use a PC, you should be desperately and deeply indebted to. He's died, Larry Tesla. He created lots of things that we take for granted, but his most important innovation, cut, copy, and paste commands on your personal computer, made them simple to learn, simple to use. Larry Tesla, 74 years old. He has died in the United States today. Without him, boy, there'd be a lot more work involved in everything you do on your PC.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, Discovery soothing investors' nerves today after a warning earlier this week that it would report a double-digit loss amidst its ongoing spending on new projects. Group profit did fall 11% to a little more than 2 billion rand. Adrian Gore is the chief executive of Discovery. He's the group chief executive of Discovery. Do you find this obligation, Adrian Gore, of reporting a trading update without the benefit of detail sort of allows distortions in market perceptions? Because the market got a terrible fright earlier on this week with your trading update. Then you clarified today the share price was massively volatile. It feels a little bit messy.
Bruce, it's a good point. I'm not sure the alternative. I think that we always have sent out a trading update, and I think that we're spending a lot with the apex of the spend on things like our bank. And so it is difficult to build an organization organically in a big listed environment. So these are tricky things. So we're trying our best to make sure the market is updated. I think the presentation today was aimed at being as detailed as possible. So I think we're doing some unprecedented things, but we believe in them. But it is hard to manage expectations, I have to say.
You are spending huge amounts of money on growth projects. Most of the billion rand you've spent over the last 6 months, that's gone into the bank, right? Which is, it turns out, quite an expensive thing to get off the ground.
It's certainly a lot of money, but I have to say, I think the team has done really well. The total spend on the bank is lower than we planned for, and the 6 months of operation have been really, really excellent. So we're feeling very good about the bank. I mean, it is a big undertaking, but we've built something, I think, very, very special, and as I say, within budget. So it's been a good story, and we're very proud of it. I mean, obviously, we've got to keep growth going. We've got to get all the stuff we said today to work, but we are very, very pleased.
Last time we spoke, you said you were investing 7.5 billion rand into the bank. Was that the budget, or was that the amount you'd spent up until then, and has it grown?
Well, it's made up of two components. It's made up of the acquisition of the Discovery card, the outstanding amount from FNB, and it's made up of the build cost. So we probably spent the majority of it, if I work it out. We're kind of close to that. There's still about 1 billion or so to go. But we're very much in line with plan, as I said, and I think we're pretty confident about its ability.
78,000 customers on your books. Is that where you wanted to be by now?
It kind of is. I mean, it's close to 80,000 clients, about 180,000 accounts. Just bear in mind, we're being very specific about aiming for customers that are going to bank with us properly, saving, depositing, borrowing, etc. And the data coming out of it really is good. You know, the deposit rates per person are above what we expected. The spend is above, the borrowings is strong. So, you know, not just the account numbers, but the qualitative numbers around how they're engaging in the program. It's early days. It's 6 months of data, to be fair. But I think it's in line with plan in terms of numbers, but it's probably ahead of the plan in terms of qualitative issues.
How many of those were existing card customers, the card customers that FNB signed up in your name?
Of the total 80,000, about 58% are former Discovery Card holders. About 42% are entirely new to the bank.
And of those, how many are sort of gold and above Vitality members? Because the idea here is you take your most engaged customers, you give them something else to engage in, you get the data, they get the benefits, and you get this virtuous circle of shared information and benefits.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the migrated clients that came out of the bill of F&B, I mean, fully 40% of them are black card holders on our bank. So that does very, very well. The other point is the levels of engagement in Vitality Money and how they're behaving in the process is really going very well. So the early signs are strong. I'll also show today some data around just if you look at the spend per person, if people are on the life plan, only the health plan or the life and health insurer, there really is a considerable correlation between people that are using our products, how much they spend and save, their bad debts go down. And there's hundreds of thousands of people in these various pools. So the potential for the bank to kind of grow into the Discovery ecosystem, in addition to the external clients, is quite tremendous.
Have you been holding new customers at bay? One gets the sense that you started with a bang and then there were some technical issues and you had to pause and build and fix and do a few things. Customer acquisition, is it at your rate or is it at the rate at which people are coming to you? Which is it?
It's a bit of both. I mean, we were late for sure for the first number of months. We should have been out there 3 or 4 months earlier. So there was that hiatus. But, you know, the focus on getting the onboarding very, very quick and in the palm of your hand has been very good. And there's been queues forming at different points that we've kind of managed very, very carefully. But I think the flow now is very, very steady. Obviously, once we migrate the bins across from F&B and we start using our distribution channels, the growth will start to accelerate. But I think you do need 6 months or so to harden systems. So, you know, it's a bit of both.
Investors have been a bit jittery about the constant spending on growth. They would like some returns to kick in, but that's not what Discovery's been about. I mean, you've constantly been expanding and growing into new projects, starting in health, going into various insurance products, and now into the bank. Are you ever going to take that foot off the accelerator? It seems like Discovery's, you know, if the speed limit's 120, you're going at 119 in a constant pace.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the emerging businesses that are now profitable, Ping An Health, the Vitality Group is globalizing, Discovery Insure. I mean, those were new starts a number of years ago. Today, they are collectively half a billion rand in profitability, growing at 20 to 30% a year. If you were to acquire those, you know, as an acquisition, they'd probably cost you 5 times or 10 times what it costs us to build. So, you know, it's not a strategy of build and just wait and see. I think our history of starting up businesses from our 8 existing businesses to the emerging has been remarkably profitable. I do have to concede what we're doing now are bigger bets. The bank is a big thing. Given the scale of Discovery, you know, our view is that to start from a new that won't be material, just doesn't warrant the time and capital. So, you know, these are bigger things that I completely concede that we need to make sure investors are kept up to date. This is a big thing. But I think the strategy is right, convinced of it.
In the same way as you've taken products and you've taken Vitality into new markets, do you see an opportunity for the bank to do that, or will the bank always be a South African operation?
You know, the bank technology and the way it's been built can be globalized and can sit on the V1 chassis that we're building across the world. I think that would be foolish to think about now. I mean, we've got so much work to do here to get the bank to scale. So intellectually, it's possible. I think strategically, tactically now, I think that'd be the wrong thing to do.
And then Vitality Life, that's giving you some problems. It's something to do with interest rates in the United Kingdom. That's actually costing you money at the moment.
Well, you know, how you value liabilities in life insurance companies very much depends on long-term rates of interest. As they've dropped really low in the UK, it just swells your liabilities. And in effect, you get a valuation loss, which is what we showed, and we tried to communicate that as best we could in the trading update. The other issue is that the operating environment is very tough. So we've slipped a bit. We're working hard to get that back. But the rate of interest, the interest rate issue is a kind of existential problem. We took a decision to actively hedge out the risk going forward, which we did. It's costly, but I think it's the right thing to do. Our approach has been, I think, also in building new initiatives, never ever to violate the capital plan, always to be very prudent. And I think the strategy in Vitality Life, which has been painful, is the right one.
And then Ping An Health in China, of course, this is the great opportunity in one of the world's most populous and prosperous economies. Things there seem to be going from strength to strength. There must be a little bit of a concern, however, as a health insurer in China right now, of the coronavirus and what the possible implications of that could be at some point in the future.
You know, the progress of their company has been remarkable. It's up to 16 million covered lives from just literally a million or so 2 or 3 years ago. So the scale of it is incredible. The coronavirus, of course, is an issue we've kept very close to. I think that just for the business itself, it doesn't operate in the Hubei province. Its exposure is very small, and the Chinese government has been fairly explicit about medical expenses from the coronavirus will be covered fully by the SHI, the social health insurance structure in the cities. So we actually don't see, I think, direct exposure and danger to it. Of course, if the virus gets dramatically worse, and I hope it doesn't, and there are, you know, fallouts of the economy and the stuff that I think most markets are worried about, that would pose a threat. But I think from a health insurance perspective, we're not particularly concerned. No hubris in that. And I also do think that the kind of nation-building social imperative that is happening is quite remarkable. The company, Ping An Health itself, is offering, you know, advice and tips and all kinds of unique coverages. So it is a moment in time that is, of course, quite scary. But, I mean, our best view is that it is a disruption that things will revert to normal.
Adrian Gore, thank you. The founder, the group chief executive at Discovery. Extraordinary South African business story. Not everybody's a fan, of course, because you get grumpy when your claims don't get paid and when there are hiccups in the systems. But it has been an extraordinary South African story. I mean, this is a company, if you think about just how reticent people are today to start anything new, to build anything new, because the future is so uncertain. And you look at the level of uncertainty in South Africa in 1992, when Adrian Gore took a trip, he would have driven his own car. It wouldn't have been a bus trip. It's not that romantic. But he went from one side of town to the other to go meet Laurie Dipenaar. I don't think they knew each other. They knew, I mean, he knew, Adrian would have known Laurie by reputation. Laurie would have been told that this was a smart young guy with a bright idea. In those days, RMB backed Adrian Gore and helped sow the seeds of Discovery. And to this day, try it. It's a good experiment. If you see Laurie Dipenaar in the shops and you just say, Discovery, he gets all like almost teary with, you know, like somebody does with their favorite kid. I'm not saying that Discovery was the favorite startup, not for a moment, but certainly there's a huge amount of pride about great South African startups, companies like Discovery.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Rudy Funimadova is a portfolio manager at Advice Works. A quick thought on Discovery, Rudy. There are so many results today to get through. Just some quick thoughts.
Bruce, I think it's clearly a period of significant investment into the business, you know, and that's what's largely brought the profits under pressure. But the emerging businesses are doing tremendously well. I think the amount of clients at Ping An's gone from 3 odd million to 50 million over the last few years. So one has to buy the longer term story, really, in Discovery. And if you do, I think there's certainly potential in a lot of these businesses to continue producing cash flow and growth.
Investors blow hot and cold on this, though. They love the long-term growth story. They love what's been achieved so far. But then they say, hold on a second, but we'd like to see a return in the short term. And then you see the share price pulling back quite dramatically. It lost about a third of its value from its peak, as investors do sort of question the just how long it is going to take to get returns from these companies. And, you know, when you look in retrospect and you go, oh, wow, look at, you know, they've built this so quickly. But, you know, in the process of building, often it feels a lot longer than it might actually be.
It does indeed, Bruce. And I think that there have been some concerns from time to time around some of the capital accounting with Discovery, saying that's quite aggressive. I think a lot of people do like the optionality of the long-term upside, but you need to be a bit patient, and it's going to take some time for the real benefits to come through. And for those that are concerned about who want to build more fat into their investment, you could still get access to it through Rand Merchant Insurance Holdings or Rand Merchant Investment Holdings, which gives you exposure of about 30% to it, where you've got a company trading at a very significant discount to the underlying value of the businesses. So you have a little bit more protection and exposure to some other quite interesting businesses as well.
It's a nice idea. Anglo American, great results out of the iron ore, great results out of platinum, horrible out of coal, horrible out of diamonds, and looking to expand in a world that isn't that keen on expansion into new resources projects. It's a gutsy move by Mark Udifani.
It is, Bruce. I suppose it's natural progression from where they've come. A few years ago, they were in a really dreadful position. They had way, way too much debt and too many assets that were almost inoperable. And they've turned those around very significantly. They've paid down the debt to far more manageable levels. And shareholders have been rewarded in that process. The business generally now is running on far more efficient metrics, and they've returned some of that cash to investors, obviously through an improved share price and through dividends and the like, and now is looking to invest. And there will be opportunities around over the next while for people who and businesses who are able to gear up when times are tough. You know, that's when the real opportunities arise.
54%. What's that number refer to? It refers to City Lodge's occupancy rates. I don't know if I've ever seen it that low.
Yeah, it's absolutely dreadful, Bruce. Yeah, and this is a company that's, by its nature, is extremely geared to occupancies. You know, a 1% or move in either direction has makes enormous difference on the bottom line. And theirs, unfortunately, has been going in the wrong direction. So their earnings are down. I think occupancies are down by about 4%, and their earnings are down in the region of 50%. So it's really looking dreadful at this stage. And in the short term, there doesn't seem to be enormous amount of recovery in the offering until we get confidence and tourism picking up.
And they're also being disrupted everywhere. I mean, they're funkier, similar concepts all over the place now. There are boutique hotels, there are B&Bs, and then, of course, there's the ever-present Airbnb. City Lodge, the original disruptor, is finding itself disrupted.
Quite right, Bruce. I think there are areas where they probably are also being a disruptor. You know, in Africa, where traditionally the quality and of, well, the access to affordable hotels, I think, has been lacking. You know, there was just a 5-star or nothing, and there they're probably making reasonable inroads, and I think their model has more acceptance. You know, it's not so easy to find a B&B in a lot of the places that they're operating in, but certainly, yes, in the domestic environment, they are going to have to box smart, because places like Airbnb are making significant inroods, no doubt.
Yeah. Truworths, they're expanding their profit margins. The share price is at, what, 50, 60% of what it was a year ago, but the only company that rebounded today at all, actually, was Truworths. The results being seen as positive.
It was somewhat positive, Bruce. I think headline earnings were up 0.4% or so. So I suspect the market had been expecting a worse result. Within these numbers, there was a bit of benefit from finance costs being lower, because they refinanced their UK debt. But there's still pressure on margins, and it looks like their credit book is under some pressure. Certainly, the provision for bad debts is escalating, and it looks like there's been change in the timing of sales, discount sales, essentially, which means that at this stage the inventories are possibly a bit higher than they would like them, about 13% higher, and I suspect some of that discounting and margin pressure is going to come through in the next period, which we're just not seeing in this particular set of numbers. So I don't know that they're quite out of the woods yet.
No. And Woolies, it just, you know, everybody's favourite shop in South Africa, those who can afford to go in, yet as an investment, what a shambles it has been.
Yeah, and another disappointing set of results. Bruce, headline earnings down 11-odd% or 12%, and I think this had been guided by them, so it's not a particular surprise. But margin pressure across the businesses, it seems like the clothing business is still struggling substantially. I think the margins in the food business also under pressure, not to a massive extent. The food results are still, I think, very credible. But I think they are in this environment finding it absolutely necessary to invest in price, really, to get sales growth. And then still David Jones is biting them and continued pressure there. Margins down by 250 basis points. And, you know, the new CEO has still to come and make his mark. And that might mean a substantial further amount of changes and write-offs and the like for him to clean out the cupboard.
There we go. Rudy van der Merwe, thank you. He is a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. Busy day on the JSE SA Inc. shares. It fell very, very sharply. One's got to assume it's in anticipation of what's going to be a tough budget next week. But good results coming out of South African companies. Companies, you know, really cutting back and trimming themselves for tough times.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you relevant market insights through the Africa Financial Markets Index report. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
I do love it when people think differently. Britain's newest polymer 20-pound note. They're making their notes out of plastic now, much more durable. But what it does is features a self-portrait of the artist J.M.W. Turner, very famous British artist, as well as one of his most celebrated paintings. It's called the Fighting Temeraire. It's a ship that was used at Trafalgar, and it's being dragged up the River Thames to be broken up years after the Battle of Trafalgar. Now, the Bank of England and Snapchat have collaborated. So if you open up the Snapchat app and you hover it over like the equivalent of a QR code on the front of the banknote, you see JMW Turner's face disappear and the painting come to the fore. And you get this magnificent image of Turner's original painting on your smartphone. It's just such a clever way of celebrating heritage and shared heritage and commonality and the brilliance of your finest citizens in a country.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, results from Anglo American Platinum and Kumba Iron Ore pointed to the fact that Anglo would be reporting solid results. De Beers had a rough year, but the company, which until recently been spending its capital on buying back its own shares, now eyeing expansion. Mark Cutifani on the line to us from London this evening, chief executive of Anglo American. Copper in Peru, potash in the United Kingdom. Those are the big immediate projects, Mark. What is giving you the confidence to spend when so many mining companies are incredibly wary of doing so?
Hi, Bruce. How are you? Great to be here. From our point of view, it's the quality of the projects that we have in the pipeline. And at Quellaveco, in terms of Sirius, the potential if we're successful. But I'd also like to say we're investing in Venetia, we're investing in Kumba, and we want to invest in Mogalakwena and the platinum business as well. So it's all about quality and continuing the improvement journey for the group.
So it's about quality of assets, not necessarily about the underlying commodity cycle, although that's, of course, important. But again, and geographies too. I mean, you're looking at South Africa, you're saying there are viable projects in this country.
Oh, yes, and you're right. We still look at commodities and make sure that we understand the pricing dynamic, because you have to assume a price. So there is some knowledge required. But when you've got low quartile cost or very low cost assets that have good characteristics, long life, flexible, then they're the sorts of assets that we do best. And when you've got those assets, you try and get them to the right size, the right potential, making sure they're making a material contribution. So for us, South Africa as a jurisdiction remains a positive and one that we do like.
So interesting from a strategic point of view, how flexible you have to be in a world that feels like it's changing faster and faster all the time. A couple of years ago, you were narrowing your focus, you were narrowing your portfolio, but now you're expanding it again. And that's, you know, it takes an enormous amount of flexible thinking to be able to do that.
Well, I think when we started, we had 68 assets, 34 of which weren't going to make or weren't likely to make a material contribution going forward. So from our point of view, the restructuring of the portfolio was about focusing on the quality and then working that quality to its potential. So even though we've halved the number of assets, our production base has actually gone up 12%, because for the assets we kept, every one of them is doing 30% better or more. And so from our point of view, it's focus on the good things you've got, work them to their potential, and as a consequence, our costs are lower by 30%, our returns are up near 20%. Every key metric, including safety in particular, has improved, and that's what positioning yourself is all about and how you deliver sustainable returns for shareholders.
A very solid performance in the platinum group metal space, boosted by considerable pricing, in particular palladium and rhodium. Iron ore prices have been very supportive. There have been issues in other countries and other supply zones that have played in your favour. Diamonds, however, not your best friend, at least not now anyway.
Well, in 2016, everybody said diamonds sparkled for Anglo because they had a great year. But from time to time, different commodities do have a tougher time. Now, obviously, diamonds, we don't even call a commodity. We call a consumer product or a luxury product. But it's been a tough year, particularly the second 6 months. But you'll have that from time to time in our industry. I think we did the right thing. We reduced our volumes, not trying to oversell in a market that had enough diamonds. So I think we've done all the right things. So hopefully the turnaround is coming quickly. We certainly saw a better first sight this year, which is what we call the sales. We have 10 sales each year, and the first one was quite positive. Still more work to be done, but the bears will come roaring back.
And what about coal? It's becoming harder and harder to fund coal projects. What is the plan for your coal assets in Anglo American?
So firstly, we've got thermal coal and we've got metallurgical coal. Thermal coal is certainly under pressure in terms of reduction of carbon footprint, and we have said that we're in the transition process. So we've actually shrunk our coal business by 60%, so that we've right out of thermal coal basically in Australia. We had reduced our thermal coal footprint by selling our domestic coal assets to Cerriti a couple of years back, and we've said that it's likely we'll transition out of the balance of our thermal coal assets over the next 5 years, or certainly within the next 5 years. So we're going to do that appropriately. We're going to make sure we're consulting governments, employees, customers, do it the right way. That's very important to us.
Yeah, big announcement today, the appointment of Natasha Viljoen as Chief Executive of Anglo American Platinum. It shouldn't be a big deal, but it is a big deal. I mean, I think this is the first woman as an operational head of any South African mining company. I stand corrected on that, but I mean, it's a remarkable step.
Well, it's a big commitment. She's got big shoes to fill. Chris did a wonderful job leading the business and driving transformation. We continue on that transformation journey, and we think Natasha, with her experience, with her capabilities and her skills, is the right person for the job. Yes, she probably comes in with a slightly different perspective, but that's what you do as you evolve and transform businesses. And certainly, given what she's done across our global business, she's made a massive difference across the business in the new technologies. She travelled the world. She's seen what goes on in other parts of the world. So we hope she can build off the great platform Chris has created to keep transforming the business and make sure that it's not only the best platinum business in the world, but it becomes the best mining business in the world.
Is mining evolved enough to accept her? I just go back to Cynthia Carroll, your predecessor at Anglo American, in that dreadful, it was a very good piece in Business Day, but Graham Boustred's withering criticism of Cynthia Carroll, primarily because she was a woman in a man's world, and he was incredibly rude about Cynthia Carroll and her appointment. I mean, Natasha Viljoen coming into a friendly or hostile environment?
Well, as far as we're concerned, we think the world has moved on. Natasha has earned the position because of who she is, what she's done in the business, and from our point of view, she deserves the role. And we don't look at her per se as a woman. We look at her as an individual that's achieved a lot in the industry and has still got a lot to contribute, and certainly from our point of view has got the right experience, the skills, the knowledge, the capability to make a difference. The fact she's a woman is a secondary issue, and certainly one that has never really crossed my mind in the 43 years I've been in the industry. I was the first executive to appoint a woman GM in Australian mining. And so from our point of view, we think it's great. She's going to do a great job.
Mark Edifani, thank you. Anglo American Chief Exec.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
Oh, the PIC report. This big report following the investigation, that inquiry that was carried out into the PIC. I was expecting to see it earlier this week, but it's not out yet. And it's getting a little bit frustrating. But more details are coming out of the PIC about investments that should never have happened. Warren Thompson, Business Day journalist. I mean, you're watching and waiting, no doubt, also for the big report. Do we have any ideas to when it'll be made public, if at all?
Evening, Bruce. Yeah, well, according to the State of the Nation last week, the president was going to release it within days. And certainly some of my sources have indicated that the report has been distributed to very select people involved in the commission, as well as the PIC. So it's definitely ready to go. It's just a case of, well, when is the president going to pull the trigger? And maybe that's going to be tomorrow.
Oh, well, we watch the space. I mean, certainly the PIC coming in dribs and drabs. The latest sort of scandal to emerge out of the PIC is an investment by the PIC into Musa Group. Musa Group is a company that's been liquidated in the High Court in Joburg in February, but a big write-off being taken by the PIC, and it's yet another sort of question mark around process within the big investment company.
Yes, Bruce. So just to kind of familiarize your audience with this deal, the Musa Group is a holding company and has a number of subsidiaries. And the PIC invested $950 million into the company in August 2015 and then went to court earlier this year to liquidate the company because it says it's owed $1.4 billion, which kind of indicates that not much of the loan was serviced. So the problem with this particular deal is that in the judgment, the judge of the High Court said that there was certainly merit in the PIC's assertion that the loan disbursement, the proceeds of the loan disbursement, and what happened to them should be investigated, which kind of indicates that there could be, at the very least, governance issues with respect to the way the money was deployed by the Musa Group. But certainly the other rather worrying development around this was that it did not receive any airtime at the PIC Commission. Now, I'm hoping that the forensic team at the PIC Commission picked up this deal and started scrutinizing it. But if we find that the deal was not mentioned or is not mentioned in the PIC Commission report, we're going to be left with the question as to, well, what else did the PIC Commission miss? And that's a pretty big question to answer, given some of the shenanigans that we've heard were going on there.
My thanks to Warren Thompson for raising the issue, and it's a good one to raise ahead of the publication of that report. We hope it comes out in the next day or two. Business Day journalist Warren Thompson on that story. But yeah, 2 trillion rand government employee pension fund. It could have to write off of 1.4 billion rand as a result of a loan made to a company that was run by 2 Americans, an Africa-focused private equity group called Musa Group, and it doesn't seem to have ended particularly well.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show. It is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that has the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Before we talk to Warren Ingram this evening, we'll talk to John Haynes, who's the head of research and the chairman of Global Investment Strategy Group at Investec Wealth and Investment. I'm looking forward to that discussion because the world is a little bit itchy and a bit scratchy at the moment and a little bit scary. So we'll do that tonight. And Pavlo Fatidis at 7:30 this evening will join us in talk all about small business. That's coming up on The Money Show this evening. Subscriber not available. So let's then say no thank you to John Haynes. They send you a little email and they say, would you like to speak to this person? And you say, well, I'd love to speak to this person. And then you make the arrangement and then you say, yes, certainly, we'll make time available for you. It's very valuable airtime that is The Money Show. And we'll promise our listeners that you will come. And then they don't come. Tikiso, are we writing him off? He's gone. Right. Warren Ingram. from Galileo.
I'm here. I promise I'm here.
You are. And he's got man flu, so it's very manly and very butch of him to come out being on death's door as he is. I've got an email. I'm glad we've got a little bit of extra time tonight because there are a couple of things I do want to touch on. So I got an email from Heather. I'm going to read you part of the email. I've taken out all the names. It says, we're looking to buy into an investment. Heather is 70-ish. Heather and her husband are about 70. We are looking to buy into an investment using a financial advisor for retirement. She sent me a later email being incredibly rude about financial advisors and investment houses and fund managers and everything else. Heather was getting excited about her issue being raised on the radio, but that's a separate issue altogether. She wants to buy into an investment using a financial advisor for retirement. Is there a website which makes comparisons on the different options? We've interviewed and received proposals from 5 different managers. Because we have so little knowledge, we do not know how to access how strong they are. They're also pretty, the people that she really likes are pretty new. Is there any website which may give us guidelines? We are wondering where we could get good advice on whether we will still get the benefits of buying overseas. The rand is so weak. We need to know when the investment, and it's this, and she carries on, but it is just this terrible burden of responsibility on people who have spent their lives earning their money and putting it aside and squirreling it away and then hitting an age where you're unlikely to get any fresh income. There's certainly not going to be any inheritances from parents and things like that. This is what you have got. And it must work for you.
Yeah, and I think it's a very intimidating in a relationship to develop for a lot of people because they, you know, I mean, it's a bit like, I guess, for me going to a surgeon or actually talking to our IT guys. I have no idea what they're saying. And I have no idea how to judge the quality of what they're saying. And you know, one might be saying chop off your foot and the other one will be saying, you know, just go for physio. And how do you know which one to deal with? So a lot of the time, you know, people find this one of the most terrifying things. And as you said, there isn't a way to kind of undo the big mistakes when you are 70 and potentially, you know, if you talk about, you know, living to age 100, then there's not much time to allow things to turn on. Fair point. I think there are a couple of things. One, she definitely done the right thing in terms of shopping around as a start. So it's kind of well known that in the financial planning industry, people don't shop around at all. They shop around much more for their phone, their TV, and their appliances than they do for someone who could help them make life-changing or life-destroying decisions. So she's done the right thing in terms of at least speaking to 3, and as you say, she's spoken to 5. So I think that's a very good start. What that does is it starts to give her a comparison between the quality and not. So even if you have no idea, who's a good advisor, who's not, who's telling you the truth, who's not, by the time you've spoken to 3, 4, or 5 advisors, you'll be able to sift it because there will be a couple of quality people that will tell you things possibly that you don't want to hear, but you need to hear. And then there'll be those that will just be pacifying you. No, you're in a fabulous position. Can I sell you this product? You just need this and this will solve all your problems.
And it's so often because, unfortunately, there's some people who have got the gift of the gab and they are confident people. They come across incredibly well. They're incredibly charming.
Yep.
And you can fall for the wiles of somebody who's not necessarily going to be the best fit for you, which is what, because it's so personal, you want to trust somebody. So if you like them, I mean, that's immediately like, oh, we can trust this person. We like them. They like us. We like each other. Oh, this is a good thing.
And I think that so I think the chemistry actually is important, but not from a salesman, schmarmy, you know, smooth slide uphill kind of a person. You don't want that. So what you want is someone that when you sit down in front of them, you can ask what you feel. Normally you'd be embarrassed to ask because you feel that maybe you should know these things, you know, and you should be able to ask the so-called dumb questions and feel nothing, feel no shame or embarrassment to ask those questions. And the person explaining the stuff to you needs to explain it to you in plain language in a way that you understand. And when you don't, or if you don't, to be able to say, can you explain that another way? I don't understand. And if you get that kind of chemistry from somebody who can explain it to you in a nice way, no jargon, not talking over you, not talking, bypassing you with lots of product and talking too quickly, then that's already a very good start. I want to answer a question about a website. I don't know of a comparison website that will do this. That will do.
There was a website many years ago when people gave away free stuff on the internet, and then it was bought by PSG. It was a funds comparison website. It compared the performance of unit trust funds,
yeah.
And it was marvelous.
It was a very nice.
And I can't even remember what it was called back then.
I want to say Equinox.
Equinox.co.za. Look at you.
I was around then.
You were. And Equinox was fabulous. But that just basically compared funds. And that's not what she's asking. She's asking whether or not there's any way of comparing financial advisors. And there isn't.
So we need to give her the pointers, I guess. And I think, you know, the one website which is I think quite helpful is the Financial Planning Institute of South Africa, because that's a so just to explain that, I mean, I don't want to use the comparison of Saiken nowadays because that's not always an endorsement, but it's the place where professional advisors who are qualified, who meet an academic standard and meet the kind of experience standards and ethical standards, that they would have a certification called the Certified Financial Planner. And on one website you can find all of those people, and you can break it down by geography and the like. So there is one website there, but it's not a comparison one. It's not going to rate them and say this one's better than that one. But that is the one place that she can look at. And I think that does lead to my next point, is I'm not too concerned when she talks about one of the companies being newish. Newish doesn't bother me. What is important is actually the person providing the advice. How experienced is that person as opposed to the company that they work for? Because if your advisor's got, and my view is you're looking somewhere around about 5 to 8 years of experience in this space. In other words, dealing with retired people who need an income from their capital and has the ability and the experience to coach them through the good times, the bad times, and help them understand the income requirements from that money and what they need to do. To me, that's a starting point. So that's going to be my very first question to the advisor. I'm probably biased around the certified financial planner part.
Well, I mean, so let's be absolutely clear on disclosures here. FPI, Financial Planning Institute, they did once name you Financial Planner of the Year. No organization is perfect. but it is the idea that the people who are listed as financial planners, you may or may not like them, you may or may not like their advice, but there are people who have gone through the rigors of qualifying as certified financial advisors, certified financial planners, the CFP.
Yeah.
It's something that, you know, there are far fewer financial planners in the world today, or people who can call themselves financial planners, because the requirements are, believe it or not, intellectually rigorous.
Yeah, and it's you can imagine it's a strain for me, but I'm holding on to it. So I think the point there is it's an academic and an ethics issue. So if you've got a blemish from an ethical point of view in your history, you can't be a CFP. So for me though, it doesn't say that every CFP is a great advisor, but I think it's at least a filter that you can use. I think the second thing will be then that advisor's experience. I think that is an important point to me. The third one, and it's not a it's neither a pro nor a con, but you need to understand it, is who does the advisor work for? In other words, do they work for a company that allows the advisor to choose a range of products and from a range of different product providers? Or does the advisor work for one company that says, you can have any car from us as long as it's a black Ford, we will sell you that? Because that's the tricky thing here. If the advisor is works for one company, just understand that. That must be made very clear to you, that advisor is probably going to, if they're a good advisor, they'll deliver great advice, but the solutions, the products that they're going to use, will come from one place. And I think that's an important point to understand. My third comment will be how that advisor and the product providers get paid in this deal, because it's a question that we're kind of often afraid to ask. We feel it's uncomfortable to say, you know, you're going to give me all this advice, but how do you get paid? And my starting point for someone in her position is you absolutely cannot be paying upfront percentage fees on investments now. You know, that to me is a big no-no. So if your advisor says to you, I'm going to charge you 2% or 5% upfront fee on your investments, and I'm going to charge you an annual fee, that's a great time to end the conversation and keep going on talking to other advisors. There's no problem. I don't have an issue if that advisor says to you, it's going to take quite a lot of planning and I'm going to charge you X amount of rands to develop the plan for you. That's great to me. But percentage fees, that where they say to you, don't worry, the product provider is going to pay the percentage, it comes out of the product or whatever, that for me nowadays is rubbish.
So specifically then to Heather's question, which is, how does she choose between the five? I mean, and it's a case of everybody's equally qualified, everybody's equally nice, everybody equally wants your business, everybody's being very charming. She has a favorite. Does she trust her instincts on this? I mean, it would be so nice to be able to get a reference from somebody who says, you know, from somebody you know and trust. Because often that word of mouth is the most powerful endorsement ever. Who's not related to anybody within the company, of course, but who can just say to you, these guys are, this is their track record, this is the way they operate, this particular guy's been here, here, and here. He's, you know, he's faced these difficult circumstances, he's made these choices, and he's guided that person in our network who knows, and you know, why don't you go talk to them as well? That is in an ideal world, but we don't talk, we don't compare notes on financial advisors in the same way as we compare notes on mechanics, for example.
And it's amazing when you talk to retired people, it's that that problem is even worse. In fact, it just seems like they don't talk to each other even, you know, nearly as much as they did in the past. So I think that's one. But I think my last comment there, when she's deciding, chemistry is important, yes, but understand the total costs of the solution that she's been provided. So that will be my last deciding factor. Is you can't go for the most expensive solutions here. You know, it doesn't matter how wonderful the company is. You know, looking at the list of companies there, I think one or two of those are really expensive businesses, and you know, their fees are so high that they will destroy the growth that she could get out of the business. So that would be a thing. And it's not just the advisor. Then it's saying to the advisor, how much are you charging me? And the whole layer of fees, every top to bottom, what am I paying?
Every single cent. And when they start going into jargon and saying, well, your total expense ratio is here, and then the provider fee is this, and then the platform fee is, I don't know, how much does this cost? If I give you 100, how much gets invested on my behalf?
Yeah, and then what she should be able to do is take all five of those and look at them side by side on her own and say, right, when one just gives you kind of a whole lot of jargon or just says, oh, my fee is only 0.5, your total cost is only 0.5, and the other four are saying, well, it's somewhere around 2%, you know someone's not telling the truth and it's probably the 0.5. They're not disclosing the whole layer of fees there.
Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital. More with him in a moment. We're going to talk about stock markets. Stock markets have been running hotter than the hottest chili sauce you've ever tried. Can we trust the markets? We'll talk about that in a moment.
The Money Show. Personal finance.
Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital. Now listen, the stock market in the United States, it's performed like we are used to the JSE used to performing at 15% a year. And it was fabulous. We enjoyed the JSE in those days. JSE has done nothing like that. And it is leading to concerns that we've got 11 straight years of gains in a row. And at some point, eventually the momentum runs out. It doesn't look like it's going to run out anytime soon, but guys are nervous.
That's true. And I think it's one of the comments that, you know, that we hear most from people about investments at the moment is, you know, I'm scared of the American market and it looking a little bit like, you know, the dot-com bubble, you know, and so that's the one issue. And I think for South Africans in particular, it's interesting to note that when America struggles, it has a huge direct impact on us straight away. So for example, if we have really positive or negative economic news in South Africa, it doesn't have such a big impact on our market as a big event in America, either economical or economic news or investment news. So it is really relevant to us, because if the American market carries on going and emerging markets, you know, get a positive spin-off of that, that'll be great for the JSE. So this is a real question a lot of people are facing. And I think, you know, even if we look at your Twitter feed where people are asking us questions, this is the theme.
Yeah.
Is, can I invest overseas? When do I invest overseas? Worried about overseas markets, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought it was interesting just to look at it. I mean, the one comment is, if we're going to make a forecast here, we're going to be absolutely wrong tomorrow. So we're not making forecasts. What we can do is we can say, let's look at the comparison, for example, between the year 2000, and that was very much a tech-driven thing, but actually it was more about internet businesses at the time. And then let's look at the situation now, because most of the companies that have done very well on the US market are actually tech businesses. However, I think there's some big differences, and I think that's the important point to understand about that time and what's happening now. And so I think the first thing is, if we look at you know, the jargon, and I hate the jargon, but this one is important, is how many years worth of profits are you paying now in a share price for the company? So they talk about a PE ratio. So very simply, you know, so if you're earning, you know, 1 rand at the moment and your share price is, your earning is, in terms of profit, is 1 rand and your share price is 100, then that means you need to make 100 years worth of profit just to pay for the share price today. In any shape or form, that's an expensive share. And usually, especially for the American market, we're talking about somewhere around a level of 20. When you're paying for 20 years worth of profit or more, then you know that the market market is now, it's not in cheap territory anymore. No matter what you do, you're in expensive territory.
So here's Nick Kunze, who is at Sanlam Private Wealth, and he was making an observation this morning saying, in my 25 years of trading options, I've never seen it this way around. Goldman's noting that trading volumes in US options are now as high as volumes of the underlying stocks at 91%. In particular, upside calls. When markets are at all-time highs, you buy puts. We're flashing amber. I mean, this is quite a technical observation, but it's basically saying that even the technical traders in the United States now are getting so frothy and excited and are pushing up valuations to such an extent, it's making him nervous.
And that so that's interesting, because you talk to a lot of people about investment markets, and I think they have an opposite view. I'm not talking about the traders specifically, but let's talk about investors. And investors are nervous. And markets don't generally crash when people are nervous. Markets generally crash when everyone says everything's amazing, the economy's pumping, you know, everything's kind of looking rosy, and we've got 5 or 10 years of wonderful growth, and this time it's different, et cetera, et cetera. All of the kind of phrases that you would hear there. However, right now, when you talk to investors, they don't say that. They say, we're worried. We're concerned. Yeah. Trump's a problem. You know, the trade war's a problem. Now it's, now it's the flu.
So what do we do?
I think be careful of making big calls. In other words, a big call would be, I'm not investing in international markets because I think the US is going to crash.
I'm selling everything in South Africa and taking my money offshore because I'm scared of next week's budget.
Yeah, and that's, that's kind of a comment at the moment. It's terrifying. I think those are big calls. My view is, if you've got a lump sum of capital that you need to invest in international markets,
trickle it in,
do it over 3 or 6 or 12 months. If you're really nervous, do it over 12 months. Probably the reasonable thing to do would be somewhere around 6 months. I think that's a decent, but you avoid that market at your peril, because those companies are nowhere near as expensive as the tech companies were in the year 2000. And they're doing a lot of things right to keep their businesses growing. They're reinvesting and that kind of thing, which I think is a good thing. When you spend a lot of money on research and development and on capital and on expansion for the future, good news that.
How scared are you of next week's budget?
I'm not really scared. I'm not, and also not hopeless. I just don't think it's going to be the firecracker that we would hope for. What I would love to see is that we get some kind of solution on or more clarity on how Eskom's going to be dealt with. I really hope that they avoid raising income taxes and those kinds of things. I've seen a few reports saying that maybe we see an increase in VAT, but I hope they leave company tax, dividends tax, and personal income tax alone. I expect that they won't do the budget creep or the inflation creep, where they allow us to kind of adjust for inflation.
Well, they took that away last year, and it's a case of after the budget, you were poorer in inflation terms. So,
And I think we will, and I don't mind it that the sin taxes go up again on consumption items. I think that's good. I'd like to see some innovation, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital, get his assessment of the budget this time next week, if he survives. Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital.
The Money Show. Small business.
Pavlo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator has sashayed into our studio for our small business feature brought to you by MyWay. Get an obligation-free business insurance quote from MyWay and you could win a billboard. MyWay is a licensed insurer and FSP, T's and C's apply. We've had wealth strategies for your personal finance. Now we need wealth strategies for business, income or equity. Just explain the different concepts before you do anything else.
So Bruce, an income business, if you have an income strategy, it means that you're going to apply your time where you're able and capable through a skill or whatever it is that you do to generate revenue in the instant that you apply your time. So, for example, think of a masseuse or a chiropractor or even a consultant or...
People who've got to show up. Basically,
people have got to show up. Unless you have your hands doing something or your mouth doing something or your brain doing something, translating into hands and mouth and giving value in the moment there and then, you have an income strategy.
Okay.
So you could be a plumber, you could be a masseuse, you could be a carpenter.
You get sick, you can't work, you don't function, you don't get paid. There's no money while you sleep.
Correct. There's nothing like that.
Right.
It's transactional to the extreme and you are the cause of the value and the transaction. Without you, without your particular capability, skill, and way of working, there is no value to be added to anybody and there's no income to be earned.
Lots of people love that. Mm. Lots of people love the fact that they're dependent only upon themselves and they turn up, they do the work, they leave, they get paid for that interaction, that moment in time. They drive home, they're not earning anything. They get stuck in traffic for 2 hours, they're not earning anything. They go home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they're not earning anything till their next appointment, possibly at lunchtime the next day. That's not an income stream that you can build wealth from, though. That you can survive on very comfortably. But
no, but you can build wealth. There's a very particular strategy for that. So, for example,
before we get to the different strategies. So that's your income strategy. Then the other one is the equity strategy.
So the equity strategy is a view that says, in doing what I do, in doing what I want to do, I'm going to build a business to do it on my behalf. In other words, I'll create a system to do what I do, which is effectively what a business is. A system effectively finds customers for you, finds leads for you, converts them into customers, and delivers a service or a product to them. It then builds and administers and maintains a relationship with the customers. If you're going to build a system to do that on your behalf, then that system lends itself to equity. In other words, you can create equity value as opposed to income value through that mechanism. The business itself carries the value and it only carries it and expresses it once the business is sold. So you earn your income at the end of the event, right at the end of the event, as opposed to per transaction, every transaction there and then. You also, in an equity environment, can allow the business to earn that revenue for you and earn that income for you. You are not the central cause of what generates that revenue or income.
You theoretically can play 6 rounds of golf a week, go on a 3-month Mauritius holiday. That never happens. So
it doesn't.
But
eventually it does. But yeah,
if you survive to retirement and have sold your business at a massive for a massive gain, then you get that life. But in that equity environment, you are freeing yourself up, therefore, to think about new ways of generating income, new ways to create that enterprise can create wealth and value over time. If you're in the income space, it becomes incredibly hard. So how do you build? We understand, I think, in the equity world, how to build value there. I think that's fairly clear. I don't think we need to focus there too much. Where we do need to focus is in the income world, where you are the individual who is seeking to monetize beyond just the hour-for-hour leasing of their time.
So there are quite a few approaches that you can take. But if you think about what makes up wealth and what wealth means, there are three levers to creating wealth. And they do work in a sequence, and then eventually they work simultaneously. If you have no wealth, if you have no financial means and financial power behind you, if you have no bedrock of capital or money behind you, the first thing you have to do is you have to make money. You've got to make money in order to then grow the money. And at the same time that you're growing it, you want to protect it. So those are the three levers that generate wealth, that create wealth. If you're in an income environment, the first thing you need to do is generate money. When you make your money in the income environment, let's say I provide you with the massage and you get paid 300 Rand or 600 Rand for the massage. A portion of that money is going to be there to help you find the next client. A portion of it will be there to put food on the table, and you must put a portion aside to invest. You save it up to a point, and then you find someone like a Warren and you say, I'm saving X Rands per month. Put it in sensible investments for me, and he'll create an investment strategy for you where you build an asset base outside of your everyday work. In that environment, you've then made money and you've begun to grow the money, the excess money that you've made. After that, you've got to protect it. If you are the cause of creating that money, the best way to protect it is to insure yourself. So you insure yourself for dreaded disease or incapacitation or whatever the case is. But if you don't insure yourself and it's only you who can generate that income, the whole wealth circle, the whole wealth formula falls down on itself and collapses. And that's where a lot of people do find themselves, because the horrible thing about being income generative is that, Bruce, you're constantly selling to deliver. And the moment you've delivered, you're back onto the selling cycle to deliver again. And it repeats itself on an ongoing basis like that. It's where most of us start. And most of us start there because most of us don't have any capital to start. And the best way to get capital is to generate it yourself, because I know very, very few people who will back someone with nothing
Absolutely.
To create something from nothing.
So, yeah, it's this idea of the multiple ways of creating your small business. Do you go the income route or the equity route? The equity route is where you want to evolve to. I mean, not everybody. People are happy to be consultants all their lives. They're happy to be living on the gig to gig, and if they can be responsible enough to be putting money aside during their time. Because the moment you get into the equity business, you have to start dealing with things like SIPs and you have to start filling in bits of paper, and you have to then start having administration. And
So look, that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is to turn around and say the gig economy, where you move from hustle to hustle, or event to event, or service to service, can wear you down. It really can wear you down. And ultimately, at the end of it, you stop earning the moment you stop working.
Yeah.
So there's a tremendous amount of risk in that, but at the same time, there's tremendous opportunity in it. And where most people start in businesses is they start as a gig. They start in the income generative environment. So, for example, let's say you emerge into the economy and you have this idea to build a business. The best way to start it is to start it with an income mindset. Because what that income mindset does is it acknowledges the following. It firstly says, well, I want to build, let's say, for example, a food services manufacturing business. Well, what do I know about food? And what do I know about selling food services? Let's say I'm going to create a pie shop, per se, or a pie manufacturing plant, and I'm going to sell my pies to various shops. The best way to start is to find a gig where you're selling pies to shops on behalf of a pie maker. Because as you start selling pies to shops, if you ask the right questions the whole time round, and you're asking the right questions because you want to get the deal done, Bruce, buy these pies from me. No. The right question is, why not?
Yeah.
And as you give an answer and you say, because they're too expensive, the right question thereafter is, why are they too expensive? Because if I can start to learn how a pie shop operates, and what makes a pie shop succeed or fail, and I start to learn about what's needed for a pie shop to buy my pies, already that market knowledge puts me in a position where if I'm saving at the same time that I'm selling pies and earning my commission, I know what kind of pies to make in order to get to a yes far quicker once I'm manufacturing my own pies. It's the best place to start in any instance. It's to start with that income generative mindset.
How does it all end? How do you create the best wealth for you? Well, I mean, ultimately, what is the best solution for you? That is the thing, the point where we need to get to with Pablo this evening. He is the founder of Auric Business Accelerator. More in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you relevant market insights through the Africa Financial Markets Index Report. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
Small business.
Pablo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator, income and equity businesses. I mean, the income business, I suppose, ends when you end, when you decide to stop or can't work or lose your voice or break a finger and you're a masseuse, you've got a bit of a problem. And if, at least if there's an equity business at play, there is an, what's that thing called? Asset of value, potentially.
Opportunity.
There's an opportunity. There's an asset of value that you could sell, whether it be it's worth 5 cents, 5 million cents, or 50 million cents. That depends entirely how well you've done.
It does. You know, the best way to actually figure out which one you want to take on board, there are two things you need to do. The first is, and Bruce, it's highly recommended that you try and start with the end in mind. And I know it's incredibly hard, because none of us are really good at understanding our futures. It's amazing. If I think back in my 20s, I never, ever thought that life would ever come to an end. It never, ever entered my mind, even remotely or slightly. And then you turn 30s, and then 30s, you go to 40s and to 50s and to 60s. And the only thing that
how
happens...
How is that for you, by the way?
It's, well, I'll tell you when I eventually get there. But the thing that the only certainty of all of it is that as time goes by, it's something you can never, ever get back. And most of us fall into a series of habits. And mostly those habits are unconscious. We simply go about doing what we do every day, believing, hoping, and praying that this business we're building with a view to develop an equity wealth opportunity will simply emerge. And the numbers are there. 5% of all businesses started eventually get sold. Only 5%. And they're people far smarter, far brighter, and far harder working than most of us, who also fail in the process. So if you don't start with the end in mind, it immediately makes you less conscious and less aware of how you're spending your time in either generating the income or building a business that can generate equity. The worst place to be is as you approach the end of your career, the end of your working life, when you choose to want to step back and you think you have invested in building an equity instance, but in truth, it's just been an exceptionally busy, noisy, crazy, wild income instance. I see a lot of people sometimes generating 30, 40, 50 million rand a year turnovers, but they themselves are still the root cause of the business. They believe because they have people and resources and a branch or two branch and a few vehicles and lots of stock, they believe that they've created their wealth outside of themselves. But when you look at the business in its own right, you don't see the makings of an asset over there.
You take them out of it and the entire house of cards collapses simply because they were it.
Completely. I mean, think about what an asset is. An asset's independent of you by definition. Mm. You know, if you have a pot of gold, the pot of gold exists whether you are there or not. The pot of gold has the potential to generate growth in its capital value. Like a share on the stock exchange. You buy it for 50 bucks, you hope one day to sell it for 100 bucks. And in the meantime, as it moves from 50 to 100 bucks, you want it to produce some dividends for you. So you have both income and an equity opportunity in the asset you've created. And most of us don't think about our businesses in that sense. Most of us get into the habit of running and building a business, seeing that we're developing more and more resources around it, believing that the chaos, people, and more resources that you employ bring into the environment of your everyday life is part of the game and part of the gig, only to realize that when you eventually get to near the end and you've got a 35, 40 million rand turnover and 20 to 50 to 100 staff and two branches and 10 vehicles, the business is actually worth something. And mostly the stats show it's not worth anything.
But that's devastating. I mean, it really must be devastating for people to come to that realization at the end of a long and very successful career where they've built up a lovely lifestyle for themselves, yet, you know, and anticipating that they'll be able to flog this business for, you know, two times turnover or whatever the case might be, that actually nobody wants it because if they're going to buy it, we want you in the business and you'll keep running it for the next 3 years for us if we're going to give this to you.
Well, Bruce, it's the worst of both worlds because, you see, at least if I commit to an income strategy, I'm making money today, I'm apportioning some of it to create money tomorrow, some of it to put food on the table and educate kids and buy a home and what have you, and some of it I'm saving by placing it in assets away from me, so that when you eventually end that career, you have assets externalized from yourself. If you believe that what you're going to do is build an equity strategy and create an asset through a business that you develop and build, and you forget to actually take a step back and say, is it working or is it not? Am I on the right path or am I not? Because you're so busy and Monday turns to Friday, January turns to December, 2018 turns into 2020 before you know it, you don't get that time back. And when the moment comes back where you look at the business and say, actually, had I gone the income route, I would have been far better off.
Yeah.
Because I would have externalized assets. The individual who's building that asset model, the equity model, the income they make in the business is reinvested consistently.
In the business.
In the business, because you believe you're going to exit with a big capital value. It's the worst of both worlds.
And you know, if you end up in hospital, you go and visit somebody in hospital and there is a young physiotherapist who comes and then tomorrow a different physiotherapist comes in, and then you work out quickly that there's a physiotherapist who's worked out how to try and create an equity model because they're employing young physiotherapists straight out of physiotherapy school and because they're learning to monetize their skill. They may be the greatest physiotherapist, but they're willing to employ others to do, they get the contracts and then put others into the jobs. And it's But that also becomes a very hard thing to do, because that's also the treadmill. Because what is the goal of the young physiotherapist? They want to do exactly what you're doing. You're creating your next competitor in that space.
Well, you know, it's a mindset. It's a change of mindset. Because really, if you think about it, there's nothing out there that cannot be turned into an asset. In terms of the work you do, whatever the work you do is, you can, if you choose to, turn it into an asset. But it requires a different commitment to an idea. So, for example, if I love physiotherapy, I genuinely, genuinely love physiotherapy, and that's why I do physiotherapy. That's one mindset. Another mindset is I love physiotherapy, and I genuinely, genuinely love what physiotherapy does for people. So what I'm going to do is create a system that will enable 100 physiotherapists to deliver the benefit of physiotherapy to patients. They're both creative acts. They both remain completely integrous to physiotherapy and why you believe in physiotherapy and what physiotherapy stands for. But they're both two very different, let's call it activities, yeah, that you would be performing. The one is immediately hands on body, and the other is creating a system that will deliver many hands on many bodies.
And if you do it right, you can still get hands on to bodies in an appropriate fashion yourself, because if that's the love, if that's the passion, that's create the system that allows it to happen, and you can still practice the art and the craft yourself.
Very definitely. You might not be at the coalface, you might not have your hands on the body, but the impact of what being at the coalface and hands on body delivers can be done at scale. And there's something enormously satisfying behind that.
Pavlo Vatidis, he is with Auric Business Accelerator.